Hello, I'm Eric Topol, Editor-in-Chief of Medscape, and joining with me today for a really special session is Dr. Nazneen Rahman from the United Kingdom. She heads up the Institute for Cancer Research at the Royal Marsden Hospital and is a very unique individual because she not only is a medical geneticist, particularly focusing on cancer biology and predisposition genes, but also a singer and songwriter. So welcome. It's wonderful to have you with us, Nazneen.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, at our Future Genomic Medicine, you were not only giving us a talk about predisposition genes for cancer, but also singing, so your original music that you wrote and an album that you just had out last year. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Can't clip my wings.
Can't clip your wings. That's symbolic about you. You're really a free spirit, and you've got a lot of talent in two diverse areas. So tell me, how did you get both into music and songwriting and singing, as well as into genetics?
Well, I actually don't find them so different. I think creativity is at the heart of both of them. I think scientific endeavors are really very creative. You have to be thinking of new ways of doing things, thinking outside of the box. So for me, science was actually a sort of creative end of medicine. As a medical doctor, you really want to follow protocols, and so science initially and getting into genetics gave me a sort of creative outlet from medicine, I think. The singing I've sort of just always done, and I think music is so important to so many people. In fact, I've met so many people at the conference here who say, oh yeah, I'm going to pick up my sax, and I'm going to, you know, music is just, I suppose, the lifeblood for so many, and I'm one of those.
Wow. So did you ever have a point in your career where you were almost had to choose and not be able to follow on both paths?
No, I've never ever thought of being a sort of professional musician in that sense. I think that, I think music is kind of my outlet, but I think to be a sort of successful musician in that sort of involves sort of aspects that I don't think I am very talented in, particularly in terms of sort of really going out there and publicising your music and doing those things. I think it's really tough being a professional musician, so being able to make the music I like, just I like it. If other people like it, that's great, but I'm just making what I like.
Well, now we get back to genetics, and I had not met you in person until your visit here to La Jolla, but I only found out about you through your incredible review paper. I see you as the leading authority in predisposition genes to cancer, the germline of cancer story. And so that article in Nature, I said, oh my goodness, you really have this whole field under your wrap. So can you give us a sense about where we are today in terms of familial cancers and how much we've learned?
It's a very exciting time, but it's also got a very long history. It's actually 20 years this year since the BRCA2 gene was identified. So we've sort of been working on this field for a long time. And I was Mike Stratton's PhD student at the time when he was cloning BRCA2. So that's how I sort of started in that area. So it's one of the sort of pioneering areas for predisposition genetics and has really pioneered a lot of different aspects of that. But the genomic technologies, the change in technologies that's happened over the last few years is now giving us opportunities to really make an impact on a massive scale for moving from sort of helping hundreds of people to thousands and millions of people. So that's really the sort of what we're able to do at the moment. We really need to capitalize on making use of these technologies so that we can deliver more impact to help more people.
Sure. Now, of course, as you alluded to, there's been so much work on BRCA for breast cancer, and you have told us about an ovarian cancer program. Maybe you can give us a bit of a summary of what that's all about.
Yes, people know that the BRCA genes are involved in breast cancer because they're the breast cancer genes, but it's always been known that they also lead to an increased risk of ovarian cancer. But what's not so well known is that actually the proportion of ovarian cancer due to BRCA is much higher than for breast cancer. About 15% of ovarian cancer is due to BRCA mutations compared to about 3-4% of breast cancers. And in terms of ovarian cancer, it's really important because ovarian cancer still is a very serious disease. Often people present late. and the outcome can be less good than we would hope. So prevention in that situation is really sought for. And once people have had their families, removing the ovaries by keyhole surgery can be very, very effective. So identifying women with ovarian cancer who've got the BRCA mutations allows us to give them the best possible treatment, and there are now new tailored treatments, particularly for BRCA mutations with the PARP inhibitors, but also then allows us to help the wider family and then prevent the ovarian cancer and potentially breast cancers in the relatives before they've developed cancer. So it's a wonderful exemplification of genomic medicine.
Yeah, it amplifies the whole potential by getting to all the families. And now, one of the things that you would ponder, before I get to that, I do want to ask you to recall for the Medscape viewers, you had this fantastic way to explain interpretation and analysis. Can you just give us a run through? I know you can't do it graphically, but about letters in a book kind of thing.
Yes, one of the things that we've been sort of struggling to communicate a little bit is in terms of genetic testing, we know that sequencing is much cheaper, so why is it sort of taking longer than we might hope to get it into the clinic? But I think that the sequencing bit of it, getting those letters, is just one part of the process of a genetic test. We found the analogy of a book to be really helpful. So when you make a book, you obviously need the letters, you need all of the letters, but you can't just have them in a random order. So getting the letters is the sequencing, but then you have to put them in the right, you've got to put them in the words, in the right sentences, get the punctuation, and that's the sort of analysis you do. It's only once you've done both those things that you can read the book and understand that its meaning and then do something about it, and it's that last bit that's the interpretation. And you need all three of those components if you're going to do a genetic test that's going to make a difference for a patient.
Yeah, and of course you noted that so much of what we get now when we do sequence and interpretation is these variants of unknown significance. You had another name for them.
these VUSs, which stands for variants of unknown significance, but also stands for very unhelpful statement.
Right.
And often I'll get called all the time that somebody's got a report and it's basically said, this is a variant of unknown significance. And they say, well, what am I meant to do with that? And that's an entirely reasonable question. And what we need to do is make sure that the reports that are going back to patients and clinicians have gone one step further and have answered that question to the best of our knowledge with the amount of information that we have today. And so that's what we try to do, give clear information about the relevance with the information we have today, but also making sure that we keep these variants in an iterative process. So if there's new information that becomes known that might change what the significance is, we can go back and give that information.
Now, you really partition things to when someone has a disease or condition and has genetics to be applied to try to help them versus what you're doing, which is they're unaffected, they're asymptomatic, they have a risk of cancer. And so the threshold has to be markedly different, as you say, to take out a body part because, of course, it could be ovarian, breasts, and many other colon. So you want to just kind of give us, that's a very important distinction that I think we need to really zoom in on.
Yes, I think that's the most important message for genomic medicine that will really make a difference, I think. Most people think of a genetic test as all the same, but the context of that testing really makes a difference. So if you've got somebody with a disease, whether it's cancer or heart disease, and you're doing that genetic test along with it, maybe MRIs or all sorts of other tests, that's just normal medicine. It's just part of the information you're trying to get together in order to make that person better. And all societies really pretty much embrace the fact that you try to make ill people better. And we should just be trying to make it as easy as possible to get all of that information so that that can be done. And quite a lot of genetic diagnoses can be clinically recognized, and that would be normally routinely done part of medicine, so we already do embrace that. But what's happened is that the issue about predictive testing, where somebody's well and you're trying to give them a window into the future, that is quite complicated both for individuals and for societies. Do we want that information? When do we want that information? What are we going to do with that information? So that does require careful consideration and thinking about. But because people think of testing all in one way, they think you have to have all of that counseling, all of that issue when you're doing a straightforward medical test. So what we've been really trying to do is to think about that separation, where you need that detailed kind of information, then of course you should have it. But when it's along with all the other tests, then actually usually we find patients have pretty straightforward decision making. That test will help me to get a better treatment. they're there. You know,
yeah,
give
yeah.
me the test.
No, that's great. You like, I love the way you take these complex things and really translate them to make them simple and practical, understandable. Now, I want to fast forward with you, because we had Marie Claire King say recently that all women should have BRCA testing. But now we have even more defined over the next few years with millions of people sequenced. We understand perhaps a bigger landscape of the genes predisposing for, at least in the germline, for cancer. Do you ever foresee a time when newborns or at some or early point in life that each person would have screening for their likelihood of developing any cancers over the course of their lifetime?
Yes, I can potentially see that coming to pass, but I think there's a lot of information we don't have at the current time. So the problem at the moment is that people think it's a fixed risk. If you have a mutation, you've got a fixed risk of getting cancer. But in fact, those mutations are just one of the different levels of things that may influence whether you're not whether or not you get cancer. And we know that exactly the same mutation in the BRCA gene may have a risk of 80% in one context, for example, if you've got a strong family history, but a much lower risk, say 40% if you don't. And we don't know what all those other factors are that are making these really big differences in risk and levels of change of risk which will impact people's behavior, because people are potentially doing very significant things like having surgery to have their parts of their body removed. So until we have got better information about that, I think we need to be cautious, because otherwise we may very easily enter into an era of sort of genetic overdiagnosis. A little bit like we've seen with the screening, with the PSAs,
yes,
that,
yes.
And it, years down the line we'll say, oh, actually, your risk wasn't that much. But it'll be difficult to know that until you've gone quite long down the line, because obviously if you do have surgery, your risk will be reduced. That will work. But it may, you may have been doing that because you thought your risk was much higher than in fact it is.
Well, your point is an excellent one. But it may be even more complex than identifying modifier genes and protective alleles, because it may not just be a sequence story.
No, absolutely.
It could be microbiome.
It could be all sorts of things. Yeah.
So it could be a long time before we can sort all this out. But perhaps someday we'll be smarter about those studies in which people are already affected with cancer to try to help all their descendants. Hopefully we can intervene at a much earlier stage.
Yes, and I mean, I am a practical individual. I suppose I do find these issues interesting, and I think they're important. But at the same time, there are ways today for a lot of different diseases and things where there is a high risk, and potentially we could do prevention for those, where we should be trying to do that. And at the same time, through the sort of initiatives that in the USA, like the precision medicine and equivalent ones in the UK and elsewhere, getting the information that will inform. But I think we should be cautious about going too far down the line before we have the correct information. And the key thing is people take information that's got in one context and they extrapolate it to a completely different context, often inappropriately. So we just have to be cautious that we're doing
sure,
that correctly.
No, that's I couldn't agree with you more. Last question is about the Angelina Jolie effect. What did you see of that? What did you make of the whole thing? And is this something that is just a short-term thing, or will it have a durable impact?
It did have quite an impact. It made people more aware. It made people, I think about the prospect of being at risk of cancer in a way where they could be empowered to make an informed decision about it. And I think that's great, because I think that is the situation. In this particular context, there's all sorts of different things potentially one could do, from surveillance to surgery. So there are options. It can give information so that people can make a more informed decision. So I think that was great. I think it was on the background of just people knowing a lot more about genetics, about DNA, genomics, people being interested. But I'm constantly just amazed by the patients I meet and just how engaged, how informed they are. So I think that's a general change.
Which is fantastic.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, no, it's great. Now, it's no surprise, having a chance to talk with you, listen to you sing and to present, that you were recognized by the BBC as one of the most influential, powerful women in the UK, and we're going to be hearing a lot more about you from you in the future. So thanks so much for joining us on this Medscape segment, and thanks to all of you for joining Medscape One-on-One.